Herzlichen Dank, Herr Kwaschorke, für die Einführung. Ich habe mich entschlossen, den Vortrag auf Englisch zu halten, zum Teil um auch Kolleginnen und Kollegen einzubinden, die einem deutschen Vortrag etwas weniger flüssig folgen können. Hauptsächlich aber wegen meinem Titel, den ich von einem englischen Essay geklaut habe und der mir deshalb auf Deutsch nicht so gut hätte gelingen können. So, I'll switch to English. Thank you all for coming. I really, really appreciate you all being here on a Monday evening with this lovely weather out there. And I also really appreciate my being here too. In the 1.5 years that I've already had the pleasure to work at this university, I have been made to feel very welcome by a wonderful group of colleagues. Thank you very much. I've seen so much enthusiasm and true spirit of collaboration in the department, and I have felt inspired and also emboldened by this supportive work environment. Emboldened enough, indeed, to step a little out of my comfort zone with today's talk. An inaugural lecture is an exceptional format. Free to talk about anything I choose, the inaugural lecture is also highly personal. It is supposed to make you better acquainted with me and my work. But it is also a rare opportunity as an academic to speak programmatically, perhaps even polemically. And so I have decided today not to present any of my research projects in detail. Rather, I want to give an account of my sense of what it is that we do as scholars in the humanities and why what we do matters. So, for better or worse, I have decided to expose you today to the full glare of my unveiled idealism. As the quotation, which serves as a sort of epigraph to my talk, already suggests, I'll take my cues in this, at least partly, from Matthew Arnold, who has provided me also with my title, which I stole from one of his best-known essays, published in 1864. Matthew Arnold was an eminent Victorian, a poet, critic, and school inspector, and one of the founding figures of cultural criticism, and I'll use his account of the role of criticism and culture as he defines it in this essay, The Function of Criticism at the Present Time, as well as in his book, Culture and Anarchy, as a sort of launching pad for my own observations today. Of course, historically, one might say that the humanities have felt the need to justify themselves ever since the rise of empirical research in the natural sciences in the 17th century, if not longer. Arnold's own position is merely one of the many versions of this debate. In education, this conflict generally took and continues to take the form of a fundamental disagreement on what the purpose of studying is supposed to be. On the one hand, it is understood as a primarily vocational training in which students are pragmatically prepared for particular professions, and where the use of studies is measured by the practical relevance of the acquired skills and students' success in landing high-earning jobs. On the other hand, and contrasting this, we have an ideal of a more general formation and cultivation of character and mind. That is an ideal of Bildung, without a specifically defined field of application. And we are clearly today, once more, at a moment at which this debate, always latent, is yet again coming very prominently to the fore. Surely, the stirring of tender conscience Arnold talks about appears to be currently spreading among humanities scholars. Even if one looks no further than this university, Achim Landwehr has addressed similar questions in his inaugural lecture only 3 months ago. They were also present as a noticeable undercurrent of a debate recently hosted by the ZKF on the future of cultural studies. Beyond Constance, numerous recent publications, particularly within the US, query the role and the future of the humanities. In the US, this inquiry responds to significant external pressure and existential worries. Student numbers are dropping, and the university finances, which in the US depend to a large degree on student fees, become increasingly precarious. Cuts often hit the humanities disproportionately, not necessarily because they aren't popular or costly, but because they tend not to create further revenue for universities in form of private venture partnerships. In the UK, too, the humanities find themselves under existential threat by dropping student numbers and budget cuts. But also from within, some raise doubts about the efficacy and relevance of our methods of close attention to individual cultural phenomena, our frequent love of the particular detail, word, and shape, in face of the pressing existential problems humanity is facing. In her recent book, The Activist Humanist, for example, Caroline Levine laments that the humanities emphasize criticism, which to her, though she acknowledges its importance, ultimately amounts to a withdrawal from the public space of action. Such criticism, she suggests, has become complicit in the destructive system we find ourselves in. So this is Levine. It seems wrong, she writes, to keep our scholarly eyes only on unsettling and dismantling. We live in an age of acute precarity. As neoliberal economics undoes hopes of secure work, and as fossil fuels radically disrupt long-standing ecosystems, we are faced not with oppressive stasis, but with rapid and destructive change. Right now, as all of us are threatened by rapid and multiplying forces of destruction, the unmaking of forms, so often the goal of artists and humanists, has become eerily consonant with domination and exploitation. Criticism, she argues, has immobilized the humanities in mourning, fatalism, and despair. What we need now is not criticism, but pragmatism. We need to ask what practical applications our skills have, how they can be used to create and shape rather than critique the forms which organize our societies. In order to face both environmental and the institutional pressures, the humanities, in her opinion, have to fundamentally question their basic convictions and aims. At least institutionally, of course, here in Germany, the humanities are in a somewhat better position than in the US and the UK, since universities are largely state-funded and somewhat less directly dependent on student numbers. But this, as we all know here, is surely no reason to feel particularly smug, as we are currently very much experiencing immediately here in Constance, finances are in jeopardy. More generally, we too see dwindling student numbers in some of our subjects. We see that funding resources, like those of the excellence strategies, are funneled predominantly towards other fields. We see that what we do as scholars in humanities is made invisible by the quantification of research success in metrics which fail to map our kinds of achievements and work processes adequately. We see our generally low research costs at a disadvantage in a system which gauges research importance by how much money it costs, how much funding needs to be raised for it. We too are in need to justify our usefulness in the face of existential crisis. The pressure is on. These are serious and multifarious challenges, and any response to these I can provide will no doubt be unsatisfactory because partial, tentative, probably controversial, and certainly highly personal, so don't get your expectations too high. But increasingly, I have come to be convinced, and I hope to justify my conviction to you today, that rather than losing relevance, the humanities have never had as important a task as they have at the current moment, a task that goes much beyond the curation of mourning and pessimism. And indeed, I do not think that this requires turning our back at criticism, becoming activists, or changing our methods or the focus of our studies radically. Rather, I think we need to perhaps remind ourselves, but certainly actively and loudly reclaim, the central social relevance of criticism itself. It is in this context that I find inspiration in Matthew Arnold's attempt to still his tender conscience. Arnold might perhaps seem a strange person to turn to. His high Victorian convictions, his blatant elitism, anti-democratic sentiments, and his deep cultural pessimism are not particularly endearing qualities from today's perspective. Arnold wanted to resist change. He deeply lamented the rise of the modern society he saw around him, and he conceived the critic to be a bulwark against this change, the one ultimately doomed to failure. And yet, I want to call some optimism from his position. I turn to him, indeed, for a utopian ideal of the critic, which I think is worth revisiting. The question Arnold faced in his essay, The Function of Criticism at the Present Time, differs somewhat from the question facing us today. In this essay, his imagined interlocutor asks, why write criticism instead of producing art? Is culture not enough? Do we actually need cultural criticism? Arnold says, yes, because it is the role of criticism to provide the material for art, and that material is ideas. Criticism, according to Arnold, brings ideas into circulation by maintaining a constant interrogation or conversation in which no idea is allowed to settle and calcify, but remains in the free movement of the mind. Criticism does not produce results. Criticism produces discourse. It produces ways of thinking, knowing, and perceiving. Therefore, Arnold's ideal of criticism is disinterestedness. Allow me one rather long quotation to illustrate Arnold's main argument. And how is criticism to show disinterestedness? By keeping aloof from practice, by resolutely following the law of its own nature, which is to be a free play of the mind on all subjects which it touches, by steadily refusing to lend itself to any of those ulterior political, practical considerations about ideas, which plenty of people will be sure to attach to them, which perhaps ought often to be attached to them, but which criticism has really nothing to do with. Its business is simply to know the best that is known and thought in the world, and by, in its turn, making this known, to create a current of true and fresh ideas. Its business is to do this with inflexible honesty, with due ability. But its business is to do no more, and to leave alone all questions of practical consequences and applications, questions which will never fail to have due prominence given to them. So Arnold's rejection of practical application, as we can see here, stems from his worry that any such application fixates an idea, gives it a specific purpose, and thereby makes an unbiased, disinterested criticism impossible. It is not that none of the ideas produced by and circulating through criticism has practical purchase, but that as soon as we enter the realm of practical application, we have left the domain of the critic. But this does not mean that Arnold believes the work of the critic has no impact. Instead, for Arnold, the production of this current of ideas is the necessary basis for all real cultural development. Arnold fleshes this idea further out a couple of years later in his book Culture and Anarchy, in which he proposes to explore the questions, I quote, what culture really is, what good it can do, what is our special need for it. Here, Arnold's thinking has progressed somewhat since the earlier essay, and a new kind of question he faces, so not why criticism, why not art, but what use is culture, makes him adjust his answer somewhat. Previously, he had stressed the role of knowledge and insight. The critic is to strive to see things as they really are and to know the best that is known and thought in the world. Now he adds that being cultured goes beyond this. It is, he says, a study of perfection. It moves by the force not merely or not primarily of scientific passion for pure knowledge, but also of the moral and social passion for doing good. This perfection, Arnold says, is to be conceived not as an end result, but as an ongoing process, not a having and a resting, but a growing and a becoming. It is, if you will, by nature transformative, and its aim lies in balance and harmony. Perfection is a harmonious expansion of all the powers which make the beauty and worth of human nature, and it is not consistent with the overdevelopment of any one power at the expense of the rest. At the same time, Arnold emphasizes that perfection is necessarily a social aim. The expansion of our humanity to suit the idea of perfection is necessarily a social, a general expansion. Perfection, as culture conceives it, is not possible while the individual remains isolated. So by shifting the focus on the ideal of perfection, Arnold's idea of culture gains a decidedly political dimension. It should not be content with the improvement of the cultured individual, but always strive for general improvement. The project of cultural criticism, thus conceived, is properly utopian. It will always strive for a better world, even if it primarily does so by exposing the faults of the present. For Arnold, this concept, this ideal of culture as the pursuit of perfection, was of particular importance because he thought it could serve as a corrective of tendencies which Arnold perceived to be dominant in society. So for Arnold, cultural criticism, can serve as a counterforce to these three tendencies. He says that the idea of perfection as an inward condition of the mind and spirit is at variance it is at variance with the mechanical and material civilization in esteem with us. About individualism, he says, the idea of perfection as a general expansion of the human family is at variance with our strong individualism, our hatred of all limits to the unrestrained swing of the individual's personality, our maxim of every man for himself. And about single-minded goal orientation, he says that the ideal of perfection as a harmonious expansion of human nature is at variance with our want of flexibility, with our inaptitude for seeing more than one side of a thing, with our intense, energetic absorption in the particular pursuit we happen to be following. Now, it strikes me that these, consumerism, individualism, and the inability to see the larger picture are still problems that beset us today. If anything, they are even more pressing than at Arnold's time. After all, today the stakes are much higher. Arnold was convinced that England was doomed to vulgarity and to succumb to what he called the Philistines, the self-satisfied middle classes striving only for material wealth and individual profit. From today's perspective, we see that the consequences of these rampant tendencies are rather more serious. nothing less than a large-scale destruction of the basic conditions of human life on the planet. If there's any hope that Arnold's program for cultural criticism can really serve as a counterforce to consumerism, individualism, and the inability to see the larger picture, then is this not an ideal still worth striving for? And is not even Arnold's disinterestedness as a basis for the continuing free play of fresh ideas, that is, the constant testing of new ideas and perspectives, essential if what we are aiming for is a change in the basic habits and structures of thought which shape our current unsustainable society? That such a fundamental change is needed is widely acknowledged. It is not knowledge which is lacking at this point. What needs to be achieved is a transformation of our patterns of thought, our cultural habits, and the infrastructural underpinnings of social organization. Various political and academic stakeholders, including the BMBF and the DHV, have been calling in this context for a great transformation. A term first used by Karl Polanyi in 1944 to describe the transition from agrarian to industrial societies in the course of the Industrial Revolution. We need another such great transformation, a transformation from an industrial to a sustainable society, and we need it urgently. That universities have an important role to play in this process is widely assumed. If we are to transform the way people think, education is clearly key. But the disciplines and research fields at the center of attention tend to be the natural and social sciences, not the humanities. Now, in spite of my full willingness to be idealistic here, which perhaps hasn't been noticed yet, I need to take care not to be misunderstood. I admit I do not share Arnold's sanguine belief in the superiority of the man of culture, and of course for Arnold, that was always a man. Indeed, Arnold himself, with his prejudices, elitism, and chauvinism, is not exactly a shining example for his own doctrine. Nor do I believe that studying in the humanities automatically turns you into a better or even only a more ecologically conscious person. Indeed, it is surely all too easy to laugh about and discredit Arnold's utopian idealism. And yet it is precisely this utopian idealism which I think is worth revaluing today. Though Achim in his inaugural talk spoke about the current lack of utopias, and that certainly seems true if we look at the prevalence of dystopian visions in current literary and media productions. But from another perspective, utopia is currently very much en vogue. What is the call for a great transformation, if not utopian? What are the 17 sustainable development goals declared by all member states of the United Nations in 2015, if not utopian? So these are, if you don't know them by heart yet. These 17 goals: no poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, gender equality. On a global scale, this is certainly utopian. And as humanities scholars, I would like to suggest Arnold can remind us of the necessarily utopian, yet still productive core of what we do. As a society, we are currently facing the challenge of having to think and act otherwise. But challenging how to think, what to think, offering alternative perspectives, divergent interpretations, new points of view, fresh currents of ideas in Arnoldian terms, that is surely what we in the humanities mainly aim to do, both in our research and in our teaching. When we approach our objects of studies, is it not usually our aim to show them in a new light, in new connections, from new perspectives, to explore how they could be seen otherwise? Nor does this work remain without impact. Several examples could serve to illustrate that Arnold was not entirely wrong with his assumption about the way in which the disinterested play of ideas can become a sort of echo chamber, which does play a role in setting social agendas. Perhaps the most obvious instance is the impact of gender theory and gender studies. My point here, though, is that much gender theory is properly utopian. Just think, for example, of the surely utopian critique of the patriarchal system of language by second wave feminists. Even the proponents of this critique were fully aware of the impossibility of breaking out of the language structures within which they had to necessarily remain if they wanted to continue to communicate. Yet the utopian force of their critique has had a significant impact on today's language practice. Their criticism was disinterested, not obviously in the sense of having no vested interests, but disinterested in the Arnoldian sense of not proposing any direct practical application, but rather promoting a general change of thought or idea. Change in actual practices and policies can happen on the basis and as a long-term result of such utopian thought. Thus, I see true transformative potential, even and perhaps especially in what is furthest removed from practice in the humanities, namely in high theory, wherever it succeeds in truly challenging our habits of thought, our basic assumptions and values, and encourages us to think otherwise. Much of current ecological theory, for instance, does or tries to do precisely that kind of work, and it is a work which I believe is of the utmost importance. But how, you may well ask, how does one get from this free, disinterested play of ideas without application, from this constant questioning and critique of the status quo, to real change? How can the critic escape critical solipsism and the isolation of the ivory tower? So here's my answer: teaching. This may not be a particularly fashionable answer. In our academic systems, we are asked to prove our excellence and our impact primarily in our activities as researchers, not as teachers. And yet, the centrality of education in the transformation of our society are clearly undeniable and are frequently emphasized. UNESCO, who has been at the forefront for promoting education for sustainable development, or they're very much in love with these acronyms, ESD, puts it as follows. Global issues such as climate change urgently require a shift in our lifestyles and a transformation of the way we think and act. To achieve this change, we need new skills, values, and attitudes that lead to more sustainable societies. Education systems must respond to this pressing need by defining relevant learning objectives and learning contents, introducing pedagogies that empower learners. Education is both a goal in itself and a means for attaining all the other SDGs, so Sustainable Development Goals. It is not only an integral part of sustainable development, but also a key enabler for it. What then are these new learning objectives? So, you know, this was published a couple of years ago already, so people have been thinking about what we actually need. And while there is some disagreement in details, there is actually a surprising degree of consensus about the key competencies involved. A recent Delphi study resulted in the following list. I'm going to talk you through this. So the relevant bit is the colorful bit here. Can ignore the rest. So these then are the competencies which education experts believe it to be essential to foster if a large-scale transformation of our society is to succeed. Students should learn to recognize and analyze complexity, to understand the entanglement of phenomena, and they need to be able to draw on knowledge beyond their narrow field of specialization. That would be the system thinking competencies. That's the lowest one here. I'm proceeding from the bottom up. Students should be able to imagine the future, various futures indeed, and to learn to deal with uncertainty and change. It's a future thinking competency. They should be aware of the values and norms that guide their own behavior and that of others, be conscious of their own positionality, and learn to negotiate conflicts arising from clashing values. It's a values competency. They should learn how to think strategically in order to pursue a goal, strategy thinking. They should learn how to put their plans into action, implementation. They should be able to use all these various competencies to solve specific problems. That's a problem-solving competency, so the one on the far right. But underlying all these competencies are two further competencies, namely the ability to empathize and collaborate. So that's the interpersonal competency. And finally, intrapersonal competency. That is, if you will, they need to become better human beings. Indeed, this final competency, the intrapersonal competence, even though it is somewhat controversial, has led to even further definition of so-called inner development goals, so IDGs, defining more closely the kind of better person we are to become. And I promise this is the final of these kind of colorful lists that I've got here. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but you might be able to see that partly this overlaps with what we've seen before. So one should have humility, be self-aware, be aware of one's own positionality. One should have empathy, critical thinking, feel connectedness to everything, I guess. So as you can see from all these lists, education for sustainable development is not merely defined by a focus on sustainability topics, but promotes a whole didactic philosophy, which stresses teacher-student collaboration rather than top-down teaching, group work, discussion, the possibility for students to position themselves and their values and reflect on them. Moreover, the classroom experience should be opened towards affects and embodiment rather than pure cogitation. Education for Sustainable Development calls for a change in the role of the teacher. Teachers no longer hold the authority of superior knowledge and directive power of knowing best, but should act as mentors and coaches in a joint learning experience. After all, if we knew so much more about sustainability than the younger generation, we would not be in this mess. The thrust here is clear. Since we know very well that the world we are living in is crumbling and radical change of some sort seems well nigh inevitable, we can no longer be certain that the jobs that we are currently preparing students for will continue to exist and matter. What we should therefore teach them, according to this logic, are the competencies that they will need to navigate such change. I might seem to have moved quite far away from Arnold by now, but perhaps you can already see where I'm heading with this. Are these competencies, these goals, these transformative skills not, to a large degree, contained in Arnold's degree, ideal of the critic? They are certainly no less aspirational and utopian. At least to me, they decidedly seem to push toward a broader ideal of Bildung in education, rather than a narrow vocational training. What is more, are not these skills and competencies, most of them, skills and competencies which we in the humanities have been trying to foster in our students all along. As a scholar of literature, I find myself constantly encroaching upon other fields of knowledge to make sense of my object of studies. I might need to understand, for example, how gas was distributed to light public streets and households at the beginning of the 19th century in order to understand the conditions and implications of literary representations of artificial illumination. I might have to read up on the state-of-the-art research about the communication between trees in order to properly understand the way such knowledge enters into the formal characteristics of recent novels. I will need to know about the second law of thermodynamics and the geologic theory of uniformitarianism if I want to understand the massive shifts in the conception of time among the Victorians and how that affected their understanding of poetry. Culture is, by definition, relational, and no cultural object can be looked at in isolation. To help my students to understand and to methodologically deal with such complexity has long been one of the central aims of my teaching. To engage with alternative worlds, to think about consequences of actions, and to imagine different outcomes, too, is very much at the heart of what we do. When we study a cultural phenomenon, we are constantly aware of its contingency, of the fact that it could always have been otherwise. In class and in their papers, our students are asked to position themselves, to engage in debate, and to reflect on their own opinions and values. Indeed, for me, a successful class is a class where I've succeeded in making students question their own basic assumptions, in which I've managed to make them see that things can be seen and thought differently, or indeed a class in which the students have made me change my perspective. Most of our teaching happens in discussion-based seminars in which students encounter and negotiate different divergent perspectives and are continuously asked to communicate and to collaborate. The outcome of such debates are to some degree unpredictable, and more often than not, I learn from and with my students. Our students are encouraged to think critically, to be aware of their own perceptual prejudices and positionality, to be able to shift perspectives, to counter difference constructively, or to encounter difference constructively, to be creative, and to communicate in a group. Very often, they have to deal with their own and each other's emotional responses to the cultural objects and histories we study. I could go on, but perhaps I have made my point sufficiently clear. If these competencies are supposed to be central for the sustainable transformation of our world, then surely our students need a broad education rather than being prepared ever more specifically for jobs in an economic system which we know to be unsustainable and in need of transformation. If the skills and goals listed here are really the goals our educational system should foster now and in the future, the humanities surely have a central role to play. Not only because we have long experience in the kind of teaching which education for sustainable development calls for, but also because our ideal is a utopian ideal, and we have need of utopia. When I thus call for transformative humanities in my subtitle, I do not mean, at least not primarily, that the humanities have to be transformed. Instead of constantly asking ourselves whether we need to do something differently, to be more activist, to use different, more empirical methods, or to focus on different kinds of phenomena altogether, I think it is time we reclaim the importance of what it is we already do, and to harness these our skills for the necessary transformation. I think it is worthwhile to reinstate an Arnoldian ideal, to cherish the classroom as one of the few spaces left in which disinterested free play of critical thought can unfold, to dare to be utopian. Now, I do not want to say that here that there's any reason for kind of self-satisfied smugness to think that all is well and we in the humanities should just carry on as we are doing, that there's no need to change. I think there's urgent need. But what I mainly think we need is more confidence in the importance of what it is we are doing. We need to communicate better what we can contribute, both to our students, within our institutions, and to the public. We need to realize and self-confidently claim the role we can and should play. We need to deliberately harness our skills and our teaching in all its utopian potential for sustainable ends. I really believe that this current political push towards education for sustainable development in higher education is a chance for the humanities to show their relevance, to show that this is what we have been doing, to show that we have a competence in this sort of teaching and to make a difference. But it is a chance which we need to actively take hold of. Now, Arnold, for his part, as I've said before, was a pessimist. He too believed himself to be the witness of a great transformation. As he puts it in his poem, Stanzas from the Grande Chartreuse, he finds himself, I quote, wandering between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born. But Arnold's sympathies are all with the dead old world, and he upheld the cultural critic as a bulwark against what he saw as the inexorable and utterly deplorable progress of modernity. The critic might be able to slow down, but not ultimately to stop the Philistines. Arnold eventually saw his only option to fall, I quote again, silent, while years engrave the brow. Silent, the best are silent now. The critic withdraws from the world in mourning. If this has ever really been a viable course, surely today this withdrawal is no longer an option. It is high time criticism found its voice and began to shout. Thank you.